Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This week's episode of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is brought to you by Prose. Casper, I just got a wonderful, wonderful haircut.
It looks so good.
Thank you. I feel great with it, but I cut off over a foot of hair, and that means my long hair was sort of pulling my curls in one way, and now that I have short hair, I need a totally different hair care routine.
Mm.
Luckily, Prose is made for people. Not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And so I used the review and refine feature, and I was like, yes, I still want vegan hair care products. Yes, I still want to smell like a lavender field, but my hair is no longer long. It is short to medium length. Please send me a different formula of shampoo and conditioner.
Prose is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/Harry Potter. So you get your free consultation and then 50% off at prose.com/Harry Potter. That's prose.com/Harry Potter.
Chapter 37, The Beginning. When he looked back, even a month later, Harry found he had only scattered memories of the next few days. It was as though he had been through too much to take in anymore. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
Before we get started, I want to let everybody know that we have launched our second What Matters class. This is a year-long spiritual journey through sacred reading with three faculty, me, Mauricio Bruce, who is leading people through their spiritual autobiographies, and Michaela Bly, who is teaching storytelling. And the books that we are doing this year are so good, Matt. We are doing A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. We are doing My Beautiful Friend by Elena Ferrante and Transcendent Kingdom by Yag Yassi. And this is a really small cohort, limited space class. And I'm really excited. And you can find out more by going to notsorryworks.com and clicking on What Matters.
Vanessa, for our Every Flavor Bean Patreon perk today, we are going to talk about childhood summers, favorite childhood summers. It's the end of this book. Harry's going off to his summer. The other students are going off to their summers. It's summer for us right now, like in the actual world. So we're going to reminisce about some happy childhood summers.
I'm so excited.
If you'd like to hear our Every Flavor Bean perks, please go to patreon.com/Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Also, remember that you can review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe for ad-free episodes there. Vanessa, today we have a story to tell us about love.
Yeah, Matt, I'm really excited to tell this story, especially today. I'm telling the story about the day my nephew was born, and we are recording on his birthday, on his fifth birthday.
Amazing.
And so it is the fifth anniversary of this story. I have this nephew, Ethan. He was the first nibbling in my life, and he was due late June. And I was on my very first pilgrimage treating Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse is Sacred with Stephanie Paulsell late May, early June of that year. But I was going to get myself to LA in order to be there when Ethan was born and attend his bris and be there to help my brother and sister-in-law. And this little jerk arrived a full 3.5 weeks early. And so I was not able to be there when he came into the world. And I was obviously very disappointed about that. But what was uncanny to me about the day that he was born is I was going back to my Airbnb with Stephanie Paulsell and Julia Argy. after we had dinner in London. We were starting the pilgrimage the following day. And I got the call from my brother that Ethan existed and was out in the world. And I was standing in front of a Waterstones in Islington in London, a bookstore in London. And I remember everything about it. I remember immediately loving this child and wanting to chronicle where I was. It felt auspicious to me that I was outside of a bookstore when I found out that he was born. And so we went inside and I bought him all the Winnie the Pooh books. And I asked, what's a really famous British, you know, children's book? And they said, The Tiger Who Came for Tea. It's the 50th anniversary. I was like, I'll buy it. Like, I just like had to buy him all the books. And then throughout the trip, we went to Vanessa Bell's house, Virginia Woolf's sister's house, and her longtime lover, Duncan Grant, painted a dog at the foot of her bed so that the dog would protect her while she slept. And I bought a print of that, and it is still above Ethan's bed. This whole trip to me became about sort of like collecting items to like bring them to this baby. And I tell this story about love because I just immediately loved him, even though I was however many thousands of miles, I was 7,000 miles away from him, and I wasn't going to be able to meet him for 10 days. And I cared while my sister-in-law was pregnant, but it's not like I had that kind of, oh my God, I have to bring things to him. But as soon as he was on the earth, I felt a connection to this child, which to me speaks to just like the profound mystery of love and the beauty of like being a mammal, that we can feel attached to each other just based on ideas, right? Like based on nothing. And I will say he's 5 now and I still love him that much. And we still read Winnie the Pooh together.
Vanessa, that's such a sweet story. The other thing it makes me think about is how, like, you know, feelings are just incomplete without action.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of a truism or a cliche that love is more than a feeling, than it is. But it is a feeling. But the thing about that feeling is that, like, even though you could not do anything material in the moment to care for this child, the feeling inside you welled up so powerfully that you had to do something. Like, you had to use your body and take some actions in the world and buy books and buy things and collect things. It's not like you went home and, like, Ethan could read all those books, right? It's not even that immediacy, right? It was just like, no. I have to use my actions and my embodiment to express this feeling because it can't be contained, right? Like, that's something about the relationship between the feeling of love and the act of love. Like I said, it's a cliche to say that love without action is incomplete. But if you've ever been in the situation like you were, where like you can't actually do anything about it, it feels incomplete. You feel profoundly dissatisfied unless I have to go do something. I have to be in the world in a different way. And that's one of the really just sweet and lovely things about the story.
Yeah, I have to buy a British edition of a book.
I have to. The Tiger Came for Tea.
I have to. Okay, Matt, it is the last chapter of book 4 and it is your turn to wrap it up. Are you ready?
Here we go.
On your mark, get set, go.
So Harry sees the Diggories and it's very sad. And then he's hanging out with Ron and Hermione and they talk and don't talk. And then they go to Hagrid's and Hagrid's like, it's coming. We're just going to be ready. And it seems kind of wise, but also scary. And then they go to the year-end feast and the year-end feast is very sad. And Dumbledore makes a toast. And then they get on the train back home. And Rita Skeeter is trapped and it's unlawful imprisonment. And then Malfoy comes and there's a big fight. And then Harry says, oh, here, friend George, you take this money and go start your joke shop because we all need a laugh.
Well done.
Thanks.
Unlawful imprisonment. Amen.
Okay, Vanessa, I'll count you in.
Great, thank you.
3, 2, 1, go.
So they don't have a Defense Against the Dark Arts final because they didn't have a teacher and they have a closing feast. And Dumbledore is like, Voldemort has risen again. Several of your parents are going to be upset that I'm telling you this, but it's really important that you know. Remember Cedric Diggory. And they, on the train back, Draco is essentially like, yeah, I'm a Death Eater, Harry. What are you going to do about it? You should have been with us the whole time. And Harry's like, still no. And everybody stuns Draco and Crabbe and Goyle. And then Vernon comes to pick up Harry.
Great job. Here's the thing about Malfoy. Like, it's false. Like, of course Harry's going to be. Like, it's not like if you were to come on our side, probably Voldemort would say, hey, welcome. Let's work together. Right? Like, that's not
Yeah, that's not how Voldemort's mind works.
That's not.
So, Matt, the obvious place to start to me in talking about love in this chapter is at the very beginning of the chapter. We see Harry interact with the Diggerys. And to me, this is just an incredibly loving exchange of not just grief and loving Cedric, the loss of Cedric, but Mrs. Diggory in particular. So, you know, Harry goes and talks to the Diggorys in order to give them a firsthand account of what happened to Cedric. And I think that this, like, craving for as much information as possible is, like, a very natural feeling. And even though this is obviously very traumatizing for Harry, it's actually adding to his trauma to, like, watch these parents completely fall apart. I think that it's really incredible to me the kindness in particular that Mrs. Diggory is able to show to Harry. It is incredible, this love that seems to be expanding past Cedric, but is including Harry.
I think that's right. But something about the gentleness of Mrs. Diggory and also her composure here, the way I read it is that she wants information, right? Like she actually wants to know more about what happened. Like part of how she can express or explore, or like you're, I was saying in response to your story, like do something about the feeling she feels is to know more about what happened, know what Cedric experienced. And so she has to comport herself in order to talk to Harry, and she has to be gentle with him because she knows he's been through this thing too. And so she has to get a good answer out of him, right? And I found his responses or her responses to Harry's responses really moving, right? Mm-hmm. Where she said, like, he didn't suffer then. Mm-hmm. And, oh, he must have been happy because he just won, right? And I find that moving because, like, she's not like, oh, I'm really proud of him because he won.
Yeah.
One of the things about love is that, paradoxically, it has no reason. It can't have a reason, right? Like, if you love someone because they won, that's not loving them. That's, you know, admiring their accomplishments. Like, love, you just love the person because they exist, right? Just like Ethan, when Ethan was born. It's not like Ethan did something great for you. On the contrary, Ethan arrived way early and made your life a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
But the fact of that existence is all it took, right? And what she cares about here is not that he won because then she could be proud of this son who was a victor. It was like, I hope his last moments were happy. Like, all I want, it's all directed at him, right? Like, it's all like, even the seeking information is to know more, to hope that whatever life he had was filled with as much joy and goodness as possible, even though it's ended, right? And that's really sad. Like, it's really tragic. And it's, I mean, it's obviously heartbreaking the way that she's asking about it. And just the kind of counterpoint between Amos's bereavement, his grief, and her kind of, I think the text says she was beyond tears. Her grief was beyond tears. Mm-hmm. The comparison or the counterposition of those two postures is really powerful. Yeah.
It is incredible also, right? The text tells us they did not blame Harry, right, for what happened. They thanked him for returning Cedric's body to them, right? Yep. Like, that there is such a clarity around Harry. Like, we would excuse them if they were like, how dare you, right? Like, if they just were fixating on the wrong thing. And then, I mean, to me, the moment where I'm like, oh, this is heroic, is when Mrs. Diggory, they get to their feet, and then she looks down at Harry and says, you look after yourself now. Yeah. There's just this expansion of care and ability to look outside of herself, even when in an incredible moment of pain. And that is a thing that I want to cultivate in myself, even when something feels like it is entirely about me, to remember, oh, other people are in the room too, and other people are having feelings too.
Yeah, and I think we shouldn't understate or even like stigmatize like the other thoughts that might be going through a parent's head in a situation like this, right?
Totally.
I'm not saying you're doing that.
Thank you for calling attention.
Yeah,
to
I
it.
Think it's worth drawing them out. Like one would assume that there's some thought in her head that goes like, Voldemort wanted to kill you, not my kid.
Yeah.
Why are you here? Right?
Yep.
My kid is the one who should be here. But that she can like hear that voice in her head, of course, what parent wouldn't have that voice, and just be able to say like, quiet. This is another 14-year-old boy who deserves to live just like my 14-year-old boy deserves to live, and I want you to live. It's unstated in this opening scene, obviously, as it ought to be, But one can imagine that this is the what's going on in the various voices of grief that are shouting inside her head. And she still kind of looks down and gently says to him, take care of yourself.
Right.
Like, yeah, you're right. That's very powerful. And it's powerful because of what she doesn't say and what we can only assume is being said by the various voices in her head.
And it ends with this really interesting moment, right, where Harry is like, here, take the money, right? Harry has been given in the previous chapter the winnings from the Four Wizard Tournament, and he doesn't want it. He's like, Cedric is actually the one who earned it. It was his kindness that, like, we even shared this. And so he offers the money to Mrs. Diggory, and Mrs. Diggory says, right, like, and we can hear it. It's written as if it's very gentle. Oh, no, it's yours, dear. I couldn't. You keep it. Mm-hmm. Which makes total sense also, right? Like, either way would make sense. I can imagine taking the money and being like, I am putting every dollar toward fighting Voldemort. I am, like, starting a foundation in Cedric's name. But you also understand why she's like, no, like, this is tainted money and I could not possibly take it.
Yeah, the text says she backs away from it, or they backed away from it, I think, right? Because it's blood money. It feels like this is the part of the scheme that killed our son. It will not feel like a reward. It'll feel like just a perpetuating sign of this loss, right? And so, but you could see it going the other way, as you said. I mean, it's just that every grief is different and every person responds to the grief differently and responds to the circumstances differently. It's just really, it's really important in telling the way that they respond.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things about the Diggory's refusal to take the money, I think another layer is that they're also saying, nope, we are going to refuse to allow anything good, quote unquote, good to come out of this. Right. This, there's not a silver lining here.
Yeah.
And that pile of money would feel too much like a silver lining. We need to just sit with, this is where we are, and I will not take any windfall, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Dumbledore's not Cedric's parent, but Dumbledore's is a little bit different in his toast at the Great Feast. You know, after this meeting with the Diggorys, Harry goes and meets with Hagrid, and then they have the year-end feast, which is usually a celebration of the winning house. In this case, it's not a celebration of the winning house. It's more like a meal of mourning, right? Like, instead of the winning house colors, everything's draped in black, and the teachers are all very solemn. And Dumbledore gives a toast to Cedric rather than the usual kind of announcement of the winning house. But then Dumbledore, like, tries to make something of the death. He tells the gathered students that Voldemort is back. He says there's going to be, like, a big fight, right? And he has this line where he says, when the opportunity arises for you to choose the right thing or the easy thing, remember Cedric. Remember that he deserved to live. And so he's saying, like, you know, basically don't let this death be in vain. He's saying this death, as tragic as it is, could be a thing that inspires all of us, rallies us together against Voldemort. And there's a sense in which I'm like, yes, right. Like, he has to tell these children what's coming, and he does need them to know the stakes of their future moral choices, right? Yeah. Like, if you choose the easy thing, children may die in the future. Remember that. Remember Cedric. On the other hand, as I read the chapter this time, there was, like, a part of me that felt a little bit uncomfortable with him lifting up Cedric as this banner, turning his death into, like, a rousing moment. It didn't feel as true and honest and as loving as what Diggory's parents are obviously going through.
Yeah. I know I've talked about this before a lot, but a friend of mine was killed when I was in high school. She was hit by a car, and the person who was driving was in his late 80s and just didn't have the reflexes to stop the car as quickly as necessary in order to not hit my friend who was walking in a crosswalk. And her parents got a law passed. I mean, it took 10 years, but there is now a law in the state of California that after a certain age, you have to get your reflexes tested, not just your eyesight tested. And, like, people in grief can do whatever they want, right? But, like, that was a beautiful, like, they were not martyring Brandy, but making sure that this thing that harmed their child would not harm another person. They found sort of a leak in the dam, and they were like, we are going to patch up this leak in the dam for other people. And so there are ways to, like, honor a death, right? Like, to me, I feel like Dumbledore should be like, we need to be safer here at Hogwarts. Like, we shouldn't have done the Triwizard Tournament here. I see now that, like, having children fight to the death is inappropriate. There is a way to use Cedric's death as a sign of things that I would be okay with, right? Like, even saying, like, look, you guys are in danger too and we have to be careful. But I think the line that really bugs me is actually a line that makes me cry every time I read it, which is, remember Cedric? Remember there was a boy who was good and kind? And I'm like, what? If Cedric wasn't good and kind, should we not be grieving him? It feels exploitative of Cedric, the way that Dumbledore is doing this, like, call to arms. It feels similar to when heads of state are, like, using, you know, deaths as an excuse to bomb, or, right, like, there's a very important line between, oh, we need a law to make sure this doesn't happen again, and look at this poster child. It means that we have to do things differently that happen to line up with my agenda.
You know, at one level, I think Dumbledore saying what he's saying, which is like, your choices in the future are going to have moral consequences, and the consequences will be the death of innocent people.
Yes.
I think it's important for him to say that.
Yes.
But you're right. I think there also is, he's using this death in order to illustrate that in a way that I'm uncomfortable with. Not only for all the reasons you described, which are also reasons, but also there's something about the difference between a headmaster and a parent. Right? Like, this was your friend's parents who were trying to get this law passed. And at the Diggories stood up at the final feast and were like, listen, Voldemort's back. Don't let our son be forgotten, right? That would feel different than Dumbledore, who is consciously right now planning to put Harry at risk and sacrifice him for the good of everybody else. Like, this is a pattern for Dumbledore. His plan for Harry is, like, this child might need to die to save everybody else, right? And so, like, the idea of lifting up the memory of another child who has died in order to rally everyone, it just, you're right, it starts to feel a little bit manipulative or exploitative. I think the line is blurry, right? Because I think you can say things like, and maybe one ought to say things like, this tragedy does illustrate to us the consequences of our moral decisions.
Right.
But I think the line between that and starting to use that memory to try to rally people in a way that starts to feel icky, that line is blurry. And maybe there isn't even a line. Maybe it's just, there's always an overlap that you can't help stepping into. Unless you're, like, someone as intimate as a parent, right?
Yeah.
If you're a person with the power to make decisions and with the power to actually risk some people's lives for the sake of other lives, there's always going to be this kind of messiness and discomfort.
My friend's parents refused to let the law be named after her. They were like, nope, it's called some sort of, like, reflex safety measure.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, you know, you talked about the idea of martyrdom.
Yep.
We didn't have an etymology corner today. We can do an etymology of martyrdom. The word martyr actually literally in Greek means witness. It means the person who was there, who saw it firsthand, right? We tend to think about martyrs, the one whose life is sacrificed for the sake of some greater good, right? But there's a difference between the way that the Diggories want to remember Cedric, right? Like, what his life means to them is that he was a 14-year-old boy, that they loved him because he was and for no other reason. And that's what he means to them. And he doesn't need to mean anything else. Whereas, like, for Dumbledore, he says those things. He was good and kind. But then he wants to use those facts in order to get to a different place, which is like, therefore, you all must do this and join me and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And he's not wrong about those things, but there's something about him taking that extra step where it expands it, like, for no other reason, this child was beloved, where it's becoming like, oh, he was beloved, therefore we need to keep, you know, you need to do what I want you to do, sacrifice the way I need you to sacrifice.
Right.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This week's episode of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is brought to you by Prose. Casper, I just got a wonderful, wonderful haircut.
It looks so good.
Thank you. I feel great with it, but I cut off over a foot of hair, and that means my long hair was sort of pulling my curls in one way, and now that I have short hair, I need a totally different hair care routine.
Mm.
Luckily, Prose is made for people. Not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And so I used the review and refine feature, and I was like, yes, I still want vegan hair care products. Yes, I still want to smell like a lavender field, but my hair is no longer long. It is short to medium length. Please send me a different formula of shampoo and conditioner.
Prose is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/Harry Potter. So you get your free consultation and then 50% off at prose.com/Harry Potter. That's prose.com/Harry Potter.
It is a loving moment to me when Dumbledore says to them, Lord Voldemort has risen. Hmm. That to me is a brave pedagogical choice of a man who is standing in front of hundreds of kids who are going to go home and tell their parents, even though the Minister of Magic is saying something different, right? That it seems very choiceful that he's like, no, you guys deserve to know the truth. And that there was a violence that happened at this school. And so I'm going to tell you that to me seems to be quite loving and respectful of the children and what they know they saw. And then he goes too far. But, you know, me and Dumbledore, we have beef going way back.
It's complicated. Complicated.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, but the 20th century French Jewish philosopher Simone Weil, she writes a lot about love. And she has this thing where, like, love doesn't expect any compensation, right? Like, love doesn't get anything back. It can't want to get stuff back. It has to be for itself, for the sake of the other. And so she says, actually, love of the dead is the purest form of love because the dead can give nothing back, right? And there's a way in which the Diggory's posture towards Cedric's death is like, he can't give us anything and we still love him. Right? Whereas Dumbledore's like, he can give us something. He can give us a rallying point. He can give us a memory around which to mobilize. It's trying to get something out of the death, which is, I think, what Vey was pointing at, and also the thing that maybe makes it start to feel like different than love or something in addition to love, even if there is loving memory in his remembrance.
It seems as though Harry has this intuitive knowledge of that, right? Where he's like, I'm not going to benefit, similarly to the Diggorys, right? Like, I am not going to benefit from Cedric's death. And that, for Harry, is encapsulated in this money, this 1,000 galleons that he has gotten for, quote unquote, winning the Dry Wizard Tournament. What a wild point of view that he won anything. Sorry, just saying that out loud. I was like, whoa, what a messed up world Harry lives in. And he has said this before, right? When he was given the winnings, he's like, Mrs. Weasley, you take it. I don't care who gets it. Like, I don't want it, right? Like, get it away from me. He offers it to Mrs. Diggory, and she's like, no, no, right? And backs away from him. But Harry sort of does brilliantly find the right people to give this money to, in my opinion. So while on the train back on the Hogwarts Express back to London, the twins go into a carriage with Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and they're chatting. And it turns out that Ludo Bagman has flat out stolen their money. I forgot this. I thought he hadn't honored the bet, but I forgot that he also didn't return the principal investment.
That so did I. I know.
Stealing. That is stealing.
It is from children.
From children. And Harry hears this, and he is in sort of like a private conversation with Fred and George, and he's like, here's the 1,000 galleons. And Fred and George are like, no, no, dude, like, that's yours. Yuck. it isn't a loving gesture at first, right? He has money that he wants to get rid of. He hears that two of his friends have been robbed by a government official. And he's like, oh, I have dirt to fill that hole here. But what's interesting to me is that as soon as he hands over the money, in my opinion, he turns it into a loving act. First of all, he's like, I want it to stay anonymous. I don't want anyone to know that the money is from me. Two, I'm worried that your mom is going to be mad at me, and I don't want your mom to be mad at me because I love her. So please don't tell your mom. And then three, he says, and buy Ron different dress robes with it. I want to take care of Ron, but you can't tell Ron that I'm the one who funded that. You have to take credit for that. And that to me takes this like profane, like just get this money off of my hands moment and actually turns it into something quite lovely. You know, Maimonides has this idea of like eight characteristics of good charity. One of the primary things that makes charity, quote unquote, good charity, if we think of charity as love, right, of giving without expecting anything back, is anonymity. And the fact that Harry is like, I don't want any credit for this, I think makes this exchange very loving. He's like, I just want this money to go somewhere good. And I want Ron to get something good. And we all need to laugh more. And like, please just never talk to me about it again.
Yeah, because it's not an exchange, right? Like, it's not actually, it's not like, oh, yes, you're going to give me something back in return.
Right. It's not an investment.
It's not an investment, right? And that's, I think that's in the spirit of what Simone Weil says, or with Ethan, right?
Like, yeah.
Ethan was not going to do anything for you. That dynamic of anonymity does make it more loving. But there's also something about the particular conditions he does put on it, right? Like, which I think you're also suggesting, right? So it's not just the anonymity. It's also there is this genuineness where, like, Harry could just have walked away from this money. I think if he hadn't talked to Fred and George, he probably would have just left it on the train for whoever found it. But he knows Fred and George so well, and he knows that actually their gift is to give joy to others, and so he wants them to have the joke shop. And he wants Ron to have new dress robes. Like, I mean, he just kind of also just, he actually wants it used to help people in the ways that they need help. You know what I mean? Like, the manner of his gift also signals how well he knows and how much he's paying attention to the people he loves and like what they want and need and how they might be happier and how they might flourish. And so the conditions he puts on it just are windows into his kind of consideration and sensitivity.
And he has wanted to find a way to give the Weasleys money for a long time to like thank them for how they really are helping raise him. And this is the way that he can do it, right? Like, this is the way he can sneak money into their hands in a way with, like, a lot of righteousness.
Yeah.
Matt, we are going to do the four reliances again today, and I have a sentence that I've picked for us. And the Four Reliances was developed in the 14th century in a Tibetan form of the Madhyamika tradition. And so I'm really excited. I'm so grateful that you taught us this Buddhist practice. So Matt, I will boldly lead us through the Four Reliances if you pick a section of the text for us.
I'd love to. You know, one thing we didn't talk about much during the theme conversation was this very brief but very intense fight between several characters, between Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle on one side, and Harry, Ron, Hermione, Fred, and George on another. So I thought maybe we could look at that scene.
Great.
So let me read the passage. It was as though someone had exploded a box of fireworks within the compartment. Blinded by the blaze of the spells that had blasted from every direction, deafened by a series of bangs, Harry blinked and looked down at the floor. Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle were all lying unconscious in the doorway.
So step one of this practice, Matt, is that we are relying on the message of what was said, not literally what is happening. So what do you think that the message is, the lesson? If this was a moral at the end of the story, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I was thinking that kind of spoke most directly to me as I was reading it just now was like, Harry doesn't know that he put a hex on them. Like, I mean, a lot of the narrative in the book is from inside Harry's head or whatever, right? And it's just like, the way the moment's described is like, you know, the moment before I started is Malfoy about to malign the memory of Diggory. And before we can complete the sentence, there's this bang of sound and noise and light. And then the sentence after I read, it was like, oh, Harry is just standing there with his wand. And he's like, oh, I guess I did something. Like he's almost out of his head when he reacts.
Yeah.
It's a spontaneous retaliation. And so, like, to me, that's the thing to be reflected upon in this passage. This is what's calling out to me is like, okay, what's this spontaneous retaliation? This almost unconscious retaliation. How about you? What spoke to you in the passage?
That a 1,000 paper cuts can cause a lot of harm. Like, I know that this is in the next couple of paragraphs, but we're going to find out what hex everybody individually did. Like, someone did jelly legs and someone else did Expelliarmus, whatever it is. But, like, you know, no one says Avada Kedavra. No one tries to actually get these three to, like, pass out. And yet...
Yeah, not even a stunning spell, right?
Yeah, there isn't even a stunning spell, exactly. But Ron, Hermione, Fred, George, and Harry, all being of one like mind in this one moment, can cause a lot of destruction. And so, yeah, it just makes me want to observe that. I don't even know that I have a lesson, but just like want to be like, oh, is this person being ganged up on? Am I being ganged up on? How does that feel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we need to have a lesson yet. I think it's just the thing to pay attention to, like the thing that's kind of merging.
Okay, so step two, Matt, we rely on the meaning and not the word. Not what you should know, but what you should do. Something immediately came to mind for me.
Go for it.
It's like, don't forget the dead, right? Like, this is them all viscerally being like, nope, Cedric, we still love Cedric. Cedric is still real. Cedric's memory still deserves, you know, respect. Even though Cedric is dead, that doesn't mean that you get to talk poorly about him. What about you?
I mean, what has me thinking about, I mean, because I'm going from this thing about retaliation, you know, I just wrote this whole book about, you know, questioning the moral value of retaliation. The thing about this scene is, like, there is no reflection. It's not like Harry, Ron, Hermione, Fred, and George, like, take a moment to pause and reflect. Would it be right to retaliate? Like, what? It's just like this flashbang. It's already done before I have the chance to reflect upon what's happened, right? And I hope that my reflections on retaliation do this, but just to like to show some understanding about the nature of human conflict, that ethical reflection is itself a luxury, right? Is itself sort of a privilege to be able to stop and pause because these situations are spontaneous and complicated, and so are our reactions.
So step three is where we rely on the real meaning, not the provisional one. So we ask ourselves, what is the deeper truth here? Matt, do you mind reading it to us again?
Sure. It was as though someone had exploded a box of fireworks within the compartment. Blinded by the blaze of the spells that had blasted from every direction, deafened by a series of bangs, Harry blinked and looked down at the floor. Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle were all lying unconscious in the doorway.
It's interesting because I actually think that this is a quote about a deeper truth, right? I know I just told this story on the podcast recently that when my younger brother was trying to go, when it wasn't his turn in cards, I smacked him. And I did not think in that moment. I was not like, he's going, I shall now smack my brother, right? Like, it was just this instinct, but it is a deeper truth about me, right? Like, and I would say there is a deeper truth being, there are several deeper truths being revealed in this group attack on Draco, Crabbe, and Goyle, which is like, if Harry is able to draw his wand and not even notice, that means that as soon as Draco, Crabbe, and Goyle enter a room, he's already on guard, right? Like, he's already, like, wand loaded. And same with Fred and George. And that the five of these people can just, like, count on being on the same side, right? Like, so the deeper truth to me is that whenever you act instinctively, that is an opportunity for reflection of, like, what was that in me? Is that something I want to harness? Like, was me smacking my little brother about my comfort level with him? Was it about my, like, sense of fairness? Was it that I'm a deeply violent person? And, like, I need to figure that out. Because anytime something instinctive comes out in us, I think it says something about us. And the question is whether to harness that about ourselves or let go of it a little bit.
Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
Reading through it again just now, I had a similar kind of reaction, which was like, the text makes a point of saying that Harry blinked after all this happened. So like all this happens in the blink of an eye. This whole reaction, everyone's reaction, this reaction of these five students, Fred, George, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, like is before Harry has a chance to blink his eye. There is that like suddenness and instinctiveness to it. There's something about sharing instincts that deeply with a group of folks.
Yeah.
Right? Like when we all have the same instinctive response to a provocation. That's actually fairly rare. You know what I mean? You could see these three, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, reacting to the provocation of bully at Hogwarts very differently. And you do see it throughout the novels, right? Like in this novel, right? When Skeeter is writing things, they react really differently to what Skeeter is doing. But here, like they share that instinct all together. I think you're right. I think it clues us into like there's a defensiveness and an anger and a resentment just below the surface of them, especially around Crabbe, Malfoy, and Goyle. I think it really is like they believe the stakes as Dumbledore has described them. It's not just bullying right now. They're saying, guess what? We're on the Death Eater's side and you all are going to die, right? Like that's the kind of deeper truth that has been triggering all of them, which makes their response so immediate and so sudden and so shared.
Yeah. So Matt, the fourth step is where we rely on our wisdom and not our reason. What experience from your own life speaks to the conversation that we've been having?
This reminds me just of like, I think I told a story on the podcast once of like the first fist fight I was in, which is very brief. There was just one punch that I threw and the other kid ran away. And I did it kind of without thinking.
Yeah.
I got hurt because of a tackle in a football game and I popped up and just hit him without thinking, although other people were kind of encouraging me to do so. But I remember afterwards, like this kid, I was going for a run and he chased me down on his bike and he like pulled in front of me and he wanted to know why I hit him. And it felt very confrontational and I didn't want to fight. But I also remember thinking like, with some regret, like, yeah, I probably did react kind of hastily. I probably shouldn't have done that, right? I wasn't going to have that conversation with that kid right then, or maybe I ought to have. But you know what I mean? I did have this instinctive moment of retaliatory violence or whatever that afterwards I was like, oh, I wasn't thinking. And now I have time to think about it. And not every thought I have about it is one that I'm proud of, right?
Like, right.
Yeah. How about you?
Amy is in a gym hockey league and I went early yesterday morning to watch her play a game. And it was really interesting just to learn about an instinct I have. You know, it was like a slightly rough playing. And obviously, like, nobody was picking on Amy, but anytime another child, like, accidentally touched her, I learned a new thing about my instinct, which is that I could feel violent towards a child and be like, get your hands off her!
Yeah.
And and part of me is disturbed by that I am capable of feeling violent towards a child. But the other part of me is like, good for me. I love her so much that, like, I want to, like, you know, protect her from everything. And so, yeah, it's just making me think that, like, often our instincts are so conflicting, which is why it's so important to, like, pause and whenever we can. I would like to make clear that I do hit my brother. I did not hit a child yesterday. I high-fived every kid. Thanks so much for picking such a juicy passage.
Thanks for leading us.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This week's voice memo is from Sophie.
Hi, this is Sophie calling from Canada. And I'm calling because I just listened to this week's podcast episode about comfort. And in Etymology Corner, Matt told us how the origins of the word have to do with giving strength. And this is different than how I normally think about comfort as more of like a soothing balm or like a cozy, cushy treatment when you're uncomfortable. And I actually realize I've been receiving a ton of comfort in terms of this encouraging, strength-giving experience because I've been looking for a job for several months and it has not been going particularly well. And some weeks I'm quite low. And a lot of people in my life are able to tell me their own experiences of career transitions or job seeking. And I find it helps me keep going. It doesn't change my situation or make things any different. I'm still unemployed, but it does help me feel like I've received a bit of strength from them and I can keep at it. But then I thought of a way more fun example having to do with this, and it reflects back to Matt and Vanessa's conversation about how Harry feels comforted simply by being in Dumbledore's office. And it made me think about what rooms do I enter and I immediately feel comforted by. And I'd be curious what you might answer to that as well, Matt and Vanessa. And for me, what I thought about as spaces where I enter and I might feel comforted is when I am swimming at the local community pool, which I do regularly. When I go into the change room, if the change room is full of a bunch of naked bodies, I feel comforted. I feel like it gives me strength. Everyone can just be naked and comfortable and have a body in that room. And I genuinely love that experience when it happens. And sometimes I go into the change room and everyone's sort of in their corner, has their towel up, and I follow the lead. I don't usually set the tone of being the nudist in the room, although I do aspire to be that person. And so not only am I curious what rooms make you feel comfortable in, I'd also like to offer a blessing to all of the naked bodies in the change room at the pool for making me feel comforted since I was a little kid and I took my first swim lessons. Thanks.
Sophie, I love that question about what rooms we feel comforted in. And mine is so obvious. It's embarrassing, Matt. Like really going to a bookstore. I'm like, look at all of the art that's being created to entertain me. I have like a vision of myself as the kind of person who has the time to read all these books. I just like bookstores soothe me and libraries. There's just something about a bookstore or a library that just makes me feel so good. It's my Dumbledore's office. What about you?
I mean, mine's the kitchen. But it's also like when you're in a stranger's kitchen or like someone's kitchen where you don't know where anything is, not comforting. Then you feel very out of place.
Yes.
But when I'm in my own kitchen or a kitchen with which I am very familiar, then I feel very comfortable. I can spend the whole day there just kind of puttering and making little things and eating things and hanging out and chatting with people. It's my favorite place. Also, Sophie, I'm so glad for you that you have comfort from your friends as you job search. I take strength and encouragement and comfort from us as well.
Yeah, job searching is the worst.
Now is the time in the podcast when we remember those in our community who have been loved and lost. Talia Fry, 44, a leader and mentor who was fun as hell. Nicole Ligi, 94, a Sephardic matriarch and gifted painter. Peggy Kiefer, 88, a grandmother and animal lover with a bold spirit who always made sure her grandchildren had a book on vacation. Martin Harrow, 89, a grandfather, husband, and chess aficionado. Pamela Burnett Kendall, 65, a dedicated teacher and a beloved mother, grandmother, sister, an ant. Let light perpetual shine upon them. Vanessa, who are you blessing this week?
Matt, I am going to bless Rita Skeeter. We did not talk about her at all. And I think it is hard to talk about Rita through the theme of love. But Hermione has found out that the way that Rita has found out all of this information about all of them, her dating Krum and Madame Maxime and Hagrid, is that Rita is an undocumented animagi. And so she has been running around as a beetle in spaces where she should not be. There should not be journalists in schools and in private conversations. And I understand, like, the British tabloids are really bad about this. And I very much believe in people's privacy. And this is really bad what Rita did. But I would say that Hermione putting her in an unbreakable jar and blackmailing her is a violent response. And if I were Rita, I would be terrified in this situation. It really bothers me that we don't get a description that there are like holes poked in the top of this for like oxygen. And so I'm going to just turn this into a blessing for anyone who feels trapped. But yeah, focusing on Rita Skeeter in this chapter. What about you, Matt? Who would you like to bless?
I'd like to bless Hagrid. You know, Hagrid, I think we've established, given his relationship to magical creatures, probably does not have an appropriate fear response. However, there is something kind of refreshing about the way he reacts to the news of Voldemort's rising, which is, you know, there's no point worrying about it. We have what we have, and what you have to do is face it. And like I said, I'm not sure coming from Hagrid, that's the best, because he tends not to be scared of things he ought to be scared of. On the other hand, it is also something I think Harry needs to hear, and that we need to hear sometimes when we know we're facing something difficult, that what we can do is get to work facing it. And I like the way Hagrid put it. So blessings for Hagrid.
Matt, next week we will be doing our wrap-up episode, all thoughts and feelings about book 4. We will be taking the long view. Very excited. And everybody be sure to tune in because we have announcements. Just a few reminders before we give our thanks. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe for ad-free episodes on Apple Podcasts or through our Patreon. This was a Not Sorry production. We are a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Caitlin Hoffmeister. We are edited and produced by AJ Uramas. Our music is by Ivan Paisout and Nick Bull, and we are distributed by Acast.
Thanks this week to Sophie for their voicemail, to Lara Glass, Ariana Nettleman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Willison, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Courtney Brown, Casper Jekyll, Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of those they have loved and lost this week. I feel like I've seen a lot of different approaches modeled, though. You know what I mean? We've had a lot of guests this book, and I feel like I've seen a lot of people come at it a different way. I still think my, like, high-stress, high-pitched voice panic
is the way to
go. Still my approach. It's just my style, you know.